Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, Gary.
Hi, Guy.
I believe you went to see Elton last night.
Yeah, I did. You know, I saw Elton John at the O2. His show is designed by Patrick Woodruff, who designs our shows.
Of course it is.
And designed
all the big shows.
All the big shows. Rolling Stones and Genesis and Source Full of Secrets, of course. He was incredible. Elton's voice... I've heard these rumours that he can't sing like he used to. Well, he's 76, right? But yeah.
But luckily it was always low. Luckily it was always like he was always a sort of tenor, baritone, wasn't he?
So. I think he's singing better than ever. I absolutely loved it. And I mean, just his playing, his chops. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to play on stage with him. So in the 80s, I played in Dublin two nights and then I played at Wembley two nights. I did Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. Which, for a kid who grew up buying those albums, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad. But what you realise when you see Elton is his legacy. What the songs he's given the world. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Dick, you know, it's but, and the show looks great.
Although, like I said, I have a thing about modern jazz. I should point out, I have actually recorded with Elton on the Road to El Dorado soundtrack that he wrote.
Did you? Was that the soap opera? No,
it could have been.
Right, go on.
No, but that thing with big shows, this is no disrespect to Patrick, who is an absolute genius, but it's, I think where we are with technology is that big events are big events. And it's like, whether it's a gig or a kind of an iPhone launch or anything, everything is this world of screen. Everything looks like Times Square or Piccadilly Circus, or even you want to go and see Hockney, you have to go and be immersed in a world of screens of...
No, you're right. You think the performance might suffer. Okay, so there is a distraction level. You know, when the videos are running and they look incredible, you know, and let's not forget, you know, Elton's really been involved in modern art for a long time. You know, he collects photographs.
That's very true.
There's a fantastic song where they show lots of Martin Parr photographs of the seaside. You know, I love his...
Yeah, yeah.
But it does take away a little bit from that. But you're filling the O2. You've got to fill the O2 or a stadium. How can you reach the back? You know. Okay, so there's plenty of Elton on the screen playing and the band playing. But I'm not sure, you know, whether that's what Elton wanted all the time. I think he really loves his visuals. But yeah, if you want what you're suggesting, you really need to go and see him at the Palladium, don't you? If he ever would.
That's the thing. Yeah, because it's the thing. Because it's... There was, especially when you get to stadium, and the O2 is, but this O2 is kind of like an arena that's sort of almost like a stadium in terms of playing. Because when it gets to stadiums, there are so few people who can actually. I mean, you see it when you see the Stones. We see how Mick is just trying to reach every person in the stadium all the time. You know,
which he does.
But whereas people do, it's very few. You know, Bono can do it. Bowie, of course, famously did it. It's one person who I've really surprised me when did it, actually, was Elvis Costello. Was when I saw him at the Tennis Centre in Melbourne years ago. And this place is huge, cavernous. You know, Pink Floyd played there. And he just did it with a three-piece and he turned it into a nightclub. He absolutely pulled you in. That's another... And just made the room tiny.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, Elton has the problem of being sort of sat at his piano. You know, he can't prowl the stage. He used to sort of fly. I mean, the other thing that you come away from that show is his loyalty to musicians. You know, Nigel Olsen still on drums.
That's right, Davy Johnson.
Davy Johnson, Ray Cooper, who's godlike, you know, on percussion.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an album that I've been playing my kids. I can never remember what it's called because it's a date. It's something of November, so something 1170. And it's Elton and Nigel Olsen and his original bass player, whose name escapes me, passed away.
Oh, now you're embarrassing me.
Yeah, well, Twitter will tell us or,
it was brilliant.
Or Instagram. And it's just the three of them. And they're like, he's 23 years old and he's playing in a radio station in front of an audience, small audience. Take Me to the Pilot's been written. They do a version of Honky Tonk Women that is unbelievable. And what you realise is 23, this much talent, this guy deserves to be a superstar still.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all I'm saying, right?
What I love, you know that he can't play an octave on the piano.
Because he's short, stubby
hands. He
can't
reach an octave.
Really?
It just goes to show.
I think Simply Red had a show designed by Patrick Woodruff.
I'm sure they did. Now, Simply Red, this is... going back through the catalogue, apart from exquisitely crafted songs, but always, always superb arrangements and production.
Yeah.
Like really, really beautifully finished.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
records.
Yeah, well, Stuart Levine produced a lot of them, didn't he?
Stuart Levine, that's right.
Levine, thank you. He came out of that, he was an American soul producer, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he did Culture Club as well, didn't he?
No, that's Steve Levine.
That's what I said, Steve Levine, not the same guy.
Our audience really trust us, you know.
No, in fact, because I know Steve Levine's brother is David Levine, the photographer who lives in Brighton.
Are you trying to sort of get out of it by going sideways?
I thought that was a beautiful bit of tap dancing, personally.
So Mick Hucknall, you know, I mean, that boy came along with such an incredible, you know, voice, didn't he? Blue-eyed soul, as they called it.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I know, unfortunately, that gig's going to come up, isn't it?
Do you know it might come up? But annoyingly, I think he saw the Pistols.
No, that's what I'm going to say.
2 months before me.
Ah, yes. I love him already.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience.
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Thanks, Mick, for coming on. And congratulations on making a new album and getting this out. And
Thank you.
We should start with that, really, and how you put this one together. Because I think it was similar to myself. You used COVID to make music.
Well, also similar in theme, the thing of looking at who you are, I think, Gary, isn't it? That's because it's very reflective, isn't it, Mick?
Well, the thing was that I made an album before COVID called Blue Eyed Soul that was intended to go out on the road. It was quite up tempo and really designed to be played on a stage. And then the inevitable COVID happened. We cancelled the tour, rescheduled it, cancelled again. Yeah. And I think we rescheduled it one more time. And by then, we just felt that the album was buried. And why I mentioned that is that album was effectively a tribute to African-American music. Even though
I was the same, Mick, because that album, I'm sorry, because the one thing that comes across from that album is fun. Like you were just really, really having fun with the album. Everything down to the artwork, the blaxploitation poster look of it.
Exactly. Everything. We wanted to take it out on the road and be able to play 3 or 4 new songs. And it didn't matter if people didn't know them because there was a beat and they could move, you know, they could dance. And effectively, that was a tribute to African-American music, people like James Brown, Otis Redding. And even though I wrote the songs, it was kind of an homage to that. So it got buried because of COVID. And then I'm sat there, probably like you, in my room, dressing room, bedroom, whatever. And I'm just sort of thinking, well, okay, what makes you tick? You know, who are you then? How do you fit in with the world? As you're looking at this disaster unfolding on television, I'm sat there with an acoustic guitar just strumming away thinking, well, I'll get better at playing guitar at least. And all of a sudden, you know, a song came like the last track on the album, actually, Earth in the Lonely Space, was the first song I wrote.
It's very psychedelic. It's got a great 60s vibe to it.
Yeah, thanks. As I said, I'm not really thinking to pay tribute to anybody at that stage. I'm just thinking, well, do something that you want to do. Show people who you actually are and forget about paying tributes or doing anything like that. And if that comes through, as you just described, that's probably because I grew up in that shit. You know, I grew up in the 1960s and lived through probably one of the great Renaissance periods of art. You know, I mean, I really think that, you know, that this period of the 60s from about 1960 to sort of 1980, and I know we're 80s artists, but I still look back and think the 60s and 70s wiped the floor with us, really, for creativity and genius.
And they've survived more than anybody else, of course.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. So if that's the influence, then it's because I was there.
Is that how you feel about... Have you always felt that about your singing and your contribution to music, that it's usually paying homage to someone?
Well, certainly if you do a cover, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I always prefer the originals, whether I've done them or not. You know, If You Don't Know Me By Now, which was a big hit for us, I still prefer Harold Melvin and Teddy Pendergrass singing it. You know, they're just tributes, yeah. They're tributes. But your own songs, it's a whole different thing with your own songs.
I think what I was trying to get at is that this idea of you know, especially when you first started and when I was making records like True, you know, it was white boys doing that kind of music hadn't really been taken very seriously. And suddenly we were making it our own. But was there a sort of... Wasn't a guilt about that, was there?
Well, I think you were... massively influenced by David Bowie, weren't you?
Yeah, but that period that I'm talking about now was I'm talking more Al Green, more Marvin Gaye, you know. That.
I'm also thinking about young Americans and the way in which British artists have throughout the years, including American artists like Elvis and Frank Sinatra, they've all taken influence from African-American music. And done something with it that made... I still think of David Bowie doing Golden Years on Soul Train, this skinny little white boy playing soul music. You know, it's just something that was around us all the time, and that applies to all three of us, I would imagine.
But don't you think that thing from the... Because I always had this theory from the 60s that basically America, and essentially Black America, would come up with these forms, which would then make their way over to England. And then we'd turn it into songs and sell it back to them.
Yeah, but the nice thing is, you know, it's kind of cross-pollination as well, you know?
Oh, no, that's what I mean, as an utterly positive thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking of Ray Charles singing Eleanor Rigby. Aretha Franklin doing Bridge Over Troubled Water. It's a cross-pollination thing. And
that's true. Otis doing Satisfaction.
Yeah, that's what I love about the whole thing, you know?
No, I just... Because that term, blue-eyed soul, sort of slightly fascinated me. I went down a bit of a rabbit hole on that because I feel sorry for the white boys who sing soul and have got green eyes, because green-eyed soul just doesn't seem to work. But apparently... People trace it back to a DJ. I don't know if you guys know about this, called Georgie Woods, who was on a Philly radio. And in 1964, he was playing the Righteous Brothers. And he needed to let his audience know that these guys weren't black. So he coined the phrase blue-eyed soul. And it was a kind of code, really. But it was interesting because then after that, the people who were called blue-eyed soul singers were like Sonny and Cher and Tom Jones, even.
Hall & Oates is where I first heard it, in the 70s, Abandoned Luncheonette.
Yeah, yeah. I actually chose the title just to throw it back at them, actually, because it is termed as being... It was seen as being a slightly derogatory term. But you know, I mean, again, I'll just go back to the Beatles' second album, You've Really Got a Hold on Me by Smokey Robinson. The whole of the first Beatles album, well, not the whole of it, but many of those are R&B covers. Arthur Alexander. So I don't think there's a blue-eyed member of the Beatles, but they're certainly, you know, edge that way, don't they?
That's it. I mean, they were into Tamla, weren't they? Those kids were buying Tamla Motown.
Exactly.
And then you've got the Who.
Yeah.
You know,
Stax.
You're also...
They were massively into Stax and Booker T and the MGs. You know, I remember when I did these dates with Ronnie Wood, when I was replacing, I temporarily replaced Rod Stewart in the Faces for a couple
amazing
a short period.
I saw you, Mick.
Thrill.
I saw you on. I was working on the Rob Brydon show, and I saw you appear on that.
Brilliant.
It was great.
Yeah. I loved it. But the reason why I mention it is that the late Ian McLagan and, you know, and Ronnie and Kenny, they were just talking about Booker T and the MGs. They just said, we started out listening to that, you know, and we thought that rhythm was really great, you know, and you could hear it in the music, you know. It's not Blue-Eyed Soul. It's all over the place. It's just completely like a beautiful virus, you know, that went everywhere.
Do you know what I also found out? This is my, and then all my boring stuff is out and gone, right? So we can just get on with the good stuff about Mick. But does anyone know who the first British artist to sign to Tamla Motown was? There you go.
Well, I'd guess Ardeen Taylor, because he's the only person I know that. Oh.
No, you're wrong. But
Ardeen Taylor.
No, it's Kiki D.
Oh, Kiki D, God bless her. Yeah, don't go breaking my heart, Kiki.
I mean, amazing. But Ardeen Taylor, that was a great record, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a ghost in my house. Yeah, that's I used to dance to that.
Oh, yeah.
I used to do twirls and never did the somersaults, but those backflips and stuff. Can't do it now, but good then.
Because you DJed from very early on, didn't you, Mick?
I used to have a show on Wednesday nights at Manchester Polytechnic called Black Rhythms. And that was when I was 20, 21. And the poster is a picture of Charlie Parker on it. And I used to play music as far back as the 40s, like Louis Jordan, some blues stuff, Sonny Boy Williamson, Muddy Waters. But at the same time, I'd be playing Shalimar and all manner of stuff, Dennis Edwards and stuff like that, all floor fillers, with just the insertions of these occasional obscure things that they'd love to dance to as well. So I'd get like 700 people in there a night. It was fantastic.
Something that we can all, you know, about the 70s and youth culture in the 70s is that we all seem to become parts of different tribes very quickly. Like for me, one minute I was a punk, then I was a Bowie kid, and then I was a soul boy, you know, and it didn't seem to, the gears never seemed to crash at any time. It all seemed to be really fluid and happened naturally, but it just gave me access to all different genres of music.
Well, I think we're all in the mutual David Bowie fan club. And one of the things that I really loved about being a teenager at school was being literally thrilled to bits to wonder what David Bowie was going to do next. You know, right from the moment where my friend Christian Brumed played me Ziggy Stardust when I was 12. He bought it on a Saturday morning. We played it in his house for the first time. And I've always thought that he was that kind of guy that could take something, but he always made it his own. You know, he always kind of did something with it that wasn't so obvious. And that's what I really admire about people that can take, musicians that can take something and make it their own. And you don't look there and think, oh, I know exactly what he's doing. But no, he's doing something else, you know, and that's a real challenge to try and do with your work.
Yeah, because obviously Bowie went from electronica to soul to, you know, to the almost punk as well in those early days of Iggy Pop influence records. I mean, he validated everything that we allowed ourselves to do.
Absolutely right. He did indeed. Yeah, that's why he's so admired now, I think.
We need to talk about your early days then, really, don't we? I mean,
we do. And yes, we know where we go. There's a gig, isn't there? There's a gig that's going to have to rear its ugly head.
He's only saying this, Mick, because virtually every week I mention that I saw the Sex Pistols. And I also mention that he didn't. So that's a significant gig for you too, isn't it?
Well, I saw them a few times. So I'm always very confused by this whole thing. because there was more than one gig at the Lesser Free Trade Hall. There was two.
There was two.
No one ever talks about it. And
is that one with Matlock? No, because
it's just the one with, and there were 18 of you in the room, and every single one shaped the 80s, right?
The way people put importance on this is a bit bizarre, really, because in all honesty, I didn't remember that. You know, the one that I always remember that was more vivid in my memory was the show that they did at the Electric Circus and I think that was because of the lineup. That show and the lineup was the Sex Pistols, the Buzzcocks, the Clash, the Damned, who didn't turn up, and Slaughter and the Dogs, the Fall. This was all on one bill.
This is a festival.
At the Electric Circus, and that was the year after. That was in 1977. And that's one I remember more than the previous one. My oldest friend, Neil, who I've known since I was 3 years old, who I gave a songwriting credit to on Holding Back the Years. He didn't write any of Holding Back the Years, but we used to write songs together. And just for the sheer memory, I gave him that. But he and I would go out to the clubs. And it was actually his elder brother who said to us, I've just seen a band called the Sex Pistols. You've got to come and see them. So he went to the very first one. Now, my memory is blurred in the second one because of the 77 gig. But apparently we went to the next one. Me and Neil went to the next Free Trade Hall gig. But it's all a blur to me.
Hang on. Was Sid Vicious playing or was it Glenn Matlock?
No. Sid. The time I saw Sid Vicious in my memory was at a gig in Huddersfield, which was the third time I saw them. As far as I remember, Glenn Matlock.
I think you saw every gig practically ever did.
Well, I've seen them. I saw them a few. I was more into the Buzzcocks, to be honest.
Yeah. Right, with Howard Devoto.
Yeah, because when Howard Devoto was with them, Neil and I thought they were going to be the next Beatles. We just thought they were amazing. Wow. And then we witnessed them have a big fight on the stage, which was hilarious.
Because what happened?
It was like handbags. It was just they weren't really fighting. They were sort of flapping. There were no punches. They were sort of slapping. It was like a handbag fight. It was hilarious.
It was an art school fight.
And that was like the last. I think that was the last gig they did together. And then.
So you witnessed the split. You saw the actual split.
Well, we didn't realise that it was at the time, but I think it was. Yeah, it was very. It was hilarious.
But that split you saw created post-punk because Howard goes off and makes Magazine, and that's
the Frantic Elevators, my first band, opened for Magazine on their very first tour. They did a show at a club called Rafters, and we'd been invited to open for them, and we were massive fans. And in fact, Barry Adamson was the bass player.
Yeah,
and John McGeoch, the late John McGeoch, who passed, I think, last year.
Fantastic, the legendary John McGeoch. Yeah.
I have to tell you, they were so lovely to us. You know, we were like 17-year-old, spotty little kids, and we thought these guys were like superstars, but they were so nice. They were really supportive. And you never forget things like that, do you? You know, when people have been, when you're starting out, and certain people really give you the push up and give you help up. It really stuck with me that they were great, as well as Mark Smith from The Fall as well was also very lovely. We toured with them briefly, so we had some great adventures early on.
But were you involved in all of that Manchester sort of post punk scene? Was Factory in your view? And
well, Factory. Was so fucking miserable. It was all like black and gloom and, you know, darkness. We were happy-go-lucky kids, you know. Half of our time we'd rehearse for a couple of hours and then we'd be off to the pub. You know, we were having a great laugh. Yeah, renting a transit van, going up and down, you know, doing John Peel sessions and stuff, going up and down the M1. To us, it was the most wonderful thing. And we thought, what are they so miserable about?
The Hunchback of Notre Dame,
yeah. Right.
which is brilliant. But what's interesting, even just in that, it's very interesting how it's so Manchester, because in your vocal, there's little snippets of, it's funny you bring up, there's definitely a bit of Marky Smith and John Cooper Clarke.
Yeah, who I really admired. And yeah. I mean, I think Mark Smith was a genius. You know, he had this way of representing his culture in the lyrics and stuff. You know, I can't describe it. It just was so part of where I grew up. He represented what we were living in better than anybody. It was magnificent.
But what stands out when you listen back to those early Frantic Elevator singles is Holding Back the Years, that which you do as a band then. It's got that great sort of baritone type guitar in it. It's almost like a Richard Hawley type thing. But you are so ahead of the curve,
Nick. I was going to say, yeah, it's the song is so much more sophisticated than the band.
Yeah.
The song and the singer.
And your, yeah.
Well, that was the inevitable evolution. You know, we were living in a flat in Hume and Moss Side, which is, you know, I don't know if you know, roughest part of Manchester. And we kept getting burgled and we had an axe by the side of the door. And I mean, it was just unbelievable, really. But there came a point, I'm 21 and I'm thinking, shit, you know, is this how it's going to be? I got to get out of here. You know, something's got to give, something's got to change. And then I met my manager, who became the Simply Red manager, Elliot.
Elliot Rashman.
Yeah, I met him through, who was my first actual manager, was a guy called Roger Eagle.
And oh, no way!
And Roger.
The legend.
Yeah. Now, Roger and I were very close. For several years, you know, I consider him, there's two real people I consider to be my real mentors. One of them is Roger Eagle, and another guy who I met later on called Nesri Ertegun. And he was the brother of Armut Ertegun, who were the co-founders of Atlantic Records. Now, Nesri was more jazz orientated, and he took a real shine to me early on as well. But Roger, a few years before then, introduced me to a whole world of rhythm and blues. I mean, I was into Mocha. Well,
he was famous for his record collection, wasn't he?
Tell me about him, yeah. Guy. Why do you know him?
He's a legendary Liverpool. Well, he's a Liverpool character, isn't he, rather than Manchester.
He wasn't a Scouser, actually. He was from a middle-class family. His mother was a Oxford intellectual. I think she was a teacher at Oxford University. I think he originally came from that area, but he moved up. He ran a club in Manchester called the Twisted Wheel, which was Northern Soul club. And then when psychedelia happened, he ran a club called the Magic Village. And then from the Magic Village, he really latched on to what was happening with the punk scene. I believe the Pistols played Eric's. Eric's club was Roger's. I think the first U2 gig on mainland Britain was Eric's, if I remember correctly. So he was incredibly influential. And so when we were starting out, he took a real shine to the Frantic Elevators, loved us, would always get us gigs whenever he could, opening for people. And at that time, Liverpool was buzzing as well, because I got friendly with Echo and the Bunnymen, with McCulloch and Pete Wiley out of Wahee, and they were all going to Roger's gigs. We'd always be there, and you know, playing his amazing jukebox and stuff. And I used to spend a lot of time with Roger after the shows, and he'd be playing me music. We'd be smoking bits of hashish and listening to dub reggae and Bobby Bland and James Brown. It was absolutely incredible for me.
He was your teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I loved him to bits, but he couldn't manage a paper bag. He was bloody useless as a manager. God bless him. And he knew that. He knew it. And that's when he passed me on to Elliot Rashman, and then my world changed.
I just want to step.
Who was Elliot doing? Was Elliot was a proper manager?
No, well, Elliot had managed a band called the Mothmen, who signed to Virgin Records very briefly, but he was an entertainment officer at Manchester Polytechnic.
It was the Mothmen had nothing to do with Vinnie Riley, did it?
I think there were sort of connections. Yeah, there was a whole little scene of these musicians around Didsbury, and they all kind of knew each other, and I think they were all kind of interconnected.
I think the link there, Gary, that you're thinking is because I think in the original lineup of Simply Red, you had guys from Jurati Cullum and the Mothmen.
That's right.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. I just want to step back a little bit, Mick, to you as a songwriter and you writing Holding Back the Years, because it's an interesting story because it goes right back to your childhood, doesn't it?
Well, I was learning to play guitar when I wrote that song. I think I knew about three chords when I wrote it. It was the second song I wrote, and I wrote it in my dad's house in my bedroom, and I had no idea what the song was about. That's the weirdest thing sometimes. You write almost in the subconscious state, and it's not sometimes you look back at the lyric and you suddenly go, oh my God, look what I just did. I had no idea.
Because there's one line I've got to focus in, which is "Strangled by the wishes of Pater, longing for the arms of Mater," is so unbelievably powerful and heartbreaking.
Well, I don't.
You must have known what you were saying then, or I don't know.
I just think I'd probably seen something on the television that was influential of it. You know, it could have been Brideshead Revisited. It could have been anything. I've no idea.
Right.
You know,
your mother left home.
I don't go round calling my dad Pater. Oh,
no, that's true. No, the wording certainly not. But that does describe exactly. It describes where you grew up, doesn't it? I mean, your house.
There was no mate.
There was no mother.
There was no Mater and Pater in East Manchester. But you know, for some
But in terms of mother and father.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But Mater and Pater.
I mean, I have no explanation as to why I wrote Mater and Pater. I guess because they rhymed. It's just incredible to think that I didn't.
You don't even notice that.
Can I offer a possible reason you did that, Mick? Because obviously this is your mum left home when you were three, and you were brought up by your dad. But maybe if you'd said, you know, father, mother, or mum and dad, it would have made it too real for you.
Removing yourself. Yeah. It's almost too obvious, isn't it? That you would. I agree. Yeah. That was probably my thinking. Yeah, I believe that.
So let's talk about the forming of Simply Red out, because really is it a band? Has it ever been a band? I mean, that's my key question, Mick. You know, or is it really always you?
Well, I mean, I could say the same about yourself, Gary. Aren't you the principal writer? Weren't you the principal writer in Sandow Ballet?
Yes, of course.
Well, you know, I think there we share a parallel, because I think both of us would have wanted to be in a band. Part of the tradition of Britain as in our generation growing up was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin. These were the people we looked up to. And I just so desperately wanted to be in a band. And, you know, I started out writing all the songs without really thinking about it, because I'm a natural songwriter. That's what I do. And the problem came about when the success happened, because my manager is tearing his hair out saying, when are you guys going to write some songs? Mick's the only one that's writing any songs. And it became more and more worrying when they realized that the songwriter makes most of the cash. And they all start. They said, "I've got a studio. I've got a studio in my flat." And I'm still writing songs on an acoustic guitar and a Walkman until about 1995. So I don't even need no studio. You know, I don't need anything. In fact, sometimes I don't even need a guitar. You know, I just sing the song into my phone. But the bottom line is this: there was no other songwriters in the band. And I got singled out more and more and more. to the extent that they began to even resent me because I was writing songs. I mean, how fucked up is that? You know? So, you know, I walk in the room and there's silence, that kind of shit. And I just thought, this is not what I deserve, and it's not where I should be. So, in essence, Simply Red is a vehicle for my songwriting. And it wasn't out of choice. That's how it evolved. I had no say in it. As I said, the manager of the band, Elliot, was trying his best to encourage the rest of the band to write songs. But if it was so easy, we'd all be doing it, wouldn't we? It's not. Songwriting is a gift in itself. And I'm very lucky to be able to sing and to write songs. And that's the way it is.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
Was there a thing where it came to a head with the first lineup, or was there a sort of gradual thing that was
actually quite amusing, because in the late 80s...
Slapping on stage!
My manager's lawyers said to them, if you don't change the contract, Mick's lawyers are eventually going to recommend to him that he sues you for mismanagement. And so they acted upon their advice of their own legal team, not mine. And they came to me and said, we have to renegotiate your deal because you're doing all the work and they're getting equal shares and it's not fair. And sooner or later, you're going to sue us for mismanagement. And that's how it evolved. So by the time I came to write the album Stars, that was just before then was when the renegotiation happened. And, you know, I was very romantic. In some respects, I still am. I just wanted to be in a band. I thought, John, Paul, George and Ringo, you know, but where was my John? Where were they? They weren't there. They weren't there.
I mean, the name of the band, obviously, was so great because it focused on this young kid who's got red hair. And who is a Labour supporter who supports Man United. it was did focus on you as a frontman completely. But let's just talk about some you know, better things, if you like, sweeter things. I think one of the great skills in at the beginning of your career was getting in Stuart Levine,
yeah,
to produce you, because he came out of that whole American soul production. I mean, whose idea was that?
I think the credit to that deserves to go to a guy called Simon Potts, who set up with his assistant Saul Galpern, who I'm still friends
yeah.
with.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know, yeah, I know yeah, Saul, yeah. I know Saul.
And he set Elektra UK up. But I didn't know at the time, but there was a lot of politics involved with Warner Brothers, Elektra Atlantic. They were pissed off, but he was the one that brought Stuart in, which was great. You know, I got on well with Stuart straight away, and he and I became very close. So I completely agree. I think it was a great move. Although actually, when we made Picture Book, we switched producers for the second album because we didn't think that the first album represented how we sounded live. And, you know, particularly the rhythm section of the band of Simply Red at that time, bass player and drummer, weren't happy with the sound of Picture Book. And I kind of felt similarly, and we were wrong. You know, we were kids and we fucked up. Alex Sadkin, who produced our second album, was a great producer.
Yeah.
You know, but he lived in a sort of a different world. It was not really organic. It was slightly mechanized and slightly robotic.
It was from that sexy Compass Point techno type, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Did you do it there? Did you do the album there?
No. We did it at Rack Studios in St. John's Wood. Oh. When Mickey Most was still alive, and you know, I have enormous respect for Alex. You know, he made some incredible records with Grace Jones, especially.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. He engineered a few James Brown singles as well, a few of the later James Brown stuff. So,
Duran, he worked with Duran, didn't he?
He had all the things, but it just didn't. I never really fitted into the 80s. I didn't think, you know, we were far more suited to the music of the 70s because I wasn't really into drum machines.
Because it's interesting that point that you just made, Mick, when you said we were worried that the record didn't sound like we did live, which is such an un-80s consideration.
Yes, well said. Absolutely. Well said. Yeah. Because we were really building up a fantastic live reputation. You know, I still think of us as predominantly... that we're a very successful live band, you know, right from the get-go. We went into the arenas really early on and have stayed there, you know, and that's partly because of the live following. You know, there are many artists that have great success with their recordings, but they can't fill space. They're still playing little theatres, you know. So we really focused on the live stuff, and I guess that's probably why we were so concerned about it even at that time.
Can I just say, you just reminded me there, Guy, mentioning Robert Palmer, you know, that Sneaking Sally Through the Alley album that came out in the 70s. I mean, that must have been a massive influence on you, wasn't it, Mick? I mean, that guy was sort of, he was definitely Blue-Eyed Soul.
You must forgive me. I was not familiar with Robert Palmer's work at all. Not even at all. The first thing I ever heard by him was that the one with the fantastic video.
It's
to love. Wow.
I didn't know him before then. I think the thing was then, I think I was like some kind of religious purist. I was completely immersed in African American music. I wasn't interested in white boys doing it, including myself. I was kind of so involved in buying stuff up, and especially reggae at that time as well. I just was just mad for it. So I was in a completely different world at that time.
Well, what's amazing, and I just want to mention this before we move on, is that Holding Back, when I read this, I didn't even know this to be the case, that Holding Back the Years came out and flopped. And they re-released, and is that obviously became one of the biggest records of all time. You know, I mean, you know, 2 years running, the most played record. I mean, it's what happened. What was the difference between the flop and the success?
It wasn't very 80s, was it? If you think about it,
did a DJ grab it? Is that what it was?
Well, apparently so. It happened, according to legend. I have Huey Lewis and the News to thank. They were.
That's a phrase you don't hear every day.
No, they were friends with Stuart Levine. In fact, I think Stuart later produced an album with them or did an album with them. But anyway, they came over to the UK and toured around about 1985, 1986. And when they went back to California, they were doing an interview in San Francisco, I believe. And the guy asked them, said, well, you know, when you were over there in the UK, did you hear any new music and stuff or something? And they said, yeah, we heard this album by this band, Simply Red. And this song, we love this song here. And they played the song on this radio station. And they got such fantastic feedback from their listenership that, you know, they played it again. And then another station picked it up. And it's very romantic, you know. And,
that really is.
And the truth is the record company had nothing to do with it. And that really tarnished my relationship anyway with the American record company, because I never thought that they fully got behind us. You know, they never quite got it. The single did amazingly well, and we got another number one a couple of albums later, but they never really did much with the album. And consequently, you know, we'd tour over there and break even, you know. A seven-piece band would really struggle to make a decent living if you're from the UK in America, because you can't make money unless you're playing arenas. So we go over there and play these theatres, do about 30 shows, come home knackered and have broken even. And by then, we were already playing arenas in the UK and Holland and Germany and Italy. We were already playing 9,000-10,000 people. And so our managers just said, we don't need to go back to America. You're making a fantastic living in Europe. You don't need to worry about America. Forget about America. And so we did. You know, we just couldn't be bothered. If you're like Led Zeppelin or U2, there's four of you. You know, it's a hell of a lot easier than having seven. That's three less airplane tickets, three less hotel rooms. You know, it really is not sustainable when you've got that amount of people.
It's funny, isn't it? Because obviously that's the case financially then. But having American successful singles from them, or even though in the 80s, now pays dividends, doesn't it? Because they're, you know, that's racking up your Spotify, your streaming, etc. You know, it's now it's the time it pays back.
Well, you couldn't be. You're absolutely correct, Gary. I am shocked by the impact that we've had on those streaming services. And some of the, I think it's our second biggest market on Spotify is America.
So do you send Huey Lewis a Christmas card every year?
It's still not economically feasible for me to tour there. I'm too long in the tooth, man. You know, I'm sort of like, I'll do 2 months a year, but I love being at home with my wife and kid. I'm a family guy. I just love being at home. You're not going to get me out for more than 2 months a year. And so you can spend 3 months just touring America, you know. Yeah.
But you've always been your shtick has always been very European anyway, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I've always thought being big in Europe is better than being big in America. I'd much rather have to slog around Europe once a year than slog around America, frankly.
Well, you know. Slogging around Madrid and Barcelona.
Slog was the wrong word.
I'm with you. It's an absolute delight, you know.
Exactly, because you're always somewhere. There's always something, you know.
Guy and I were on tour together last year in Europe. We did virtually every country in Europe, but I think what that really meant to us, Guy, is we visited every gallery and cathedral.
That's exactly how I feel about it. Western Europe is relatively small compared to the United States, but the cultures, the variation in each of the countries, even if they're members of the EU, they still have the originality. And I get such delight out of performing and being in those cities. Like, as you just said, going to a gallery, just walking along a river, whatever. I'm happy. Yeah. I'm happy.
Exactly. Because I must say, Mick, you were the first. I remember when Stars came out, right, which were, you know, enormous album. What was so nice, you said, is one of the things about it. You're the first person who I ever heard sort of say public out loud, as it were, that one of the things it was about was what a great thing the European Union is. And I just remember thinking, yeah, God, yeah. I hadn't really thought about that.
Well, I just thought it brought people together.
Well, absolutely.
And it did. You know, but let's not even go there. I don't.
Let's not go there, exactly.
I'll tell you where we can go.
It was a little just a little positive move.
I'll tell you where we can go. Is during this period as well, you started writing with Lamont Dozier. And I just wanted to know how that was for you to walk into the room and see him there. Yeah. And what was the process?
Well, that was one of the great thrills of my career, I have to say. And that happened quite early on, actually, because I was under such pressure to write songs, as I said, because no one else was doing it. When we came to the end of the Picture Book album, we were still touring, and I was supposed to get together a whole album of songs by myself, effectively. And, you know, it was still relatively new to me, songwriting. You know, I was getting good at it, but I still had a lot to learn. And through the wisdom of Stuart Levine and my manager, Elliot, Stuart actually produced that wonderful song by Lamont, Going Back to My Roots, the original version of it.
So good. Yeah.
Magnificent. I don't know if you've got the 12-inch single, the extended version. It's absolutely glorious, you know. And he recommended that I meet up with Lamont, and I was thrilled. You know, I mean, Jesus Christ, I must have had about 15 or 20 Motown singles that I didn't even know Lamont wrote that I had, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I started looking at them going, Holland Dozier, holy shit, this guy's amazing. And I got the chance. And so one morning in Los Angeles, I got in a cab, went down to Lamont's home in Sherman Oaks, California, mm-hmm. which I always thought was very funny because I had a Lenny Bruce sketch about this place in Sherman Oaks. It was where all the Jewish people lived in California. So there I am with Lamont Dozier in Sherman Oaks. I thought that was hilarious at the time. Anyway,
the other side of the hill.
I go into his space. And so Lamont was kind of like a Tin Pan Alley type guy, you know. He'd have his breakfast and he would literally just sit in front of the piano like a job. You know, every morning he'd go into his little room and start banging out ideas on the piano every morning. So I went in there and joined him, thrilled to bits, you know, like a little kid in a sweet shop. And he was very kind of brotherly and paternalistic with me. He was very, very kind and, you know, just really lovely, very, very warm person and funny too. Very dry, dry sense of humor, which I really appeals to me. The funniest part of it was I had to control the guy. He was like a machine. I've got, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. And as I've got the tape recording, pressing the thing, he's moved on to the next idea. I said, wait, slow down. He goes, come back here. Yeah. Repeat that. Do that again. And so he gave me about sort of 20 bars of a riff that I'd record. And then there'd be something else. So by the time I walked out of his place after 2 or 3 hours, I had about sort of, it was a complete mess on my cassette machine. It was just all, there was like 5 or 6 ideas, no structure, no lyrics, but just this, a lot of melody and a lot of riffs. And out of that.
And that's cool, but his chords are amazing.
Yeah. So
yeah,
I then went away and created songs out of them, right, effectively. And we did two of his songs are on the second album, the Men and Women album, Infidelity and a song called Suffer. And then the best part came when I did another 2 songs with him on the New Flame album, the third album, which was one of my favorite songs we ever wrote together, called You've Got It, and which is a really beautiful kind of soul ballad. And that was a delight. But I could, when you look at the songwriting credit, Holland, Dozier, Holland, after having worked with Lamont, you know exactly what Holland and Holland did, because they would put the things together, because Lamont was just an ideas man, and you had to put him in order. You had to, you know what I mean? You had to put him in a box to control the ideas, because otherwise, you'd end up with like 500 riffs and no songs. you know. Mm-mm. So that was effectively how it worked with me and Lamont.
And this is what led to that rather, one could say, cheeky songwriting credit.
Yeah, well, I did it again. It was cheeky. His wife was furious with me about that. But the truth is, he didn't really write the songs. He gave.
Hang on. You need to.
We need to tell our listeners because the standard songwriting credit for him is Holland Dozier Holland.
Right.
And your songs, Mick, I believe, are credited to Hucknall Dozier Hucknall.
Yeah. Which, again, it was pure tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. In actual fact, it was real. Because Lamont didn't write any of the lyrics. I wrote all of the lyrics. And I wrote all the melodies on top of the riffs. You know what I mean?
So he didn't sit there singing. He wouldn't sing a melody to you and you took that away. He was just really just banging it out and you were singing the melody, right?
Yeah, well, he did a little bit. I remember on the song Infidelity, he was it was a bit like that, you know, but I had to kind of put the structure together. I had to organise the arrangement. So I thought it was a fair deal, in fact, but... When we came to do the third album, they were so pissed off that I just said, okay, I'll go 50-50, even though you've not written any of the lyrics, even though you've not written hardly any of the melodies on top of the chords, whatever, out of sheer respect and admiration, fine, you know? I mean, there was never any weirdness between me and Lamont, but God bless his wife, she's a Rottweiler. And she was protecting her husband's interests, and I don't even hold that against her. Fair enough, you know, no big deal. It was a wonderful experience with him, and he was a great, great person and a lovely, lovely personality too.
After something like 12 times platinum in the UK. I mean, it's best selling album 2 years running, wasn't it? 1991, 1992. How do you go to the next
album?
How did you feel as such a huge celebrity who, you know, let's face it, as we suffered too, was kind of getting no respect from the artier journalists, you know, from the old rock journalists, but was a massive act. But how do you follow it up and how were you dealing with it?
That's a really great question. My first instincts to answer it was that one of the successes of Stars came about to something we've just previously talked about, which was the live reputation. We were, you know, from 1985 to 1990, I was pretty much on tour all of the time. And we were building up an incredible following, a live following. So by the time Stars came out, there was a great deal of anticipation from everybody that regularly went to see us live. So that impact hit really well at the beginning of the project. Plus also, I realized now that I composed three or four really strong radio-friendly tracks. Like Something Got Me Started, Stars, especially those two, really kicked it in. It was just one of those things, wasn't it? You know, every artist has their moments. You know, the Beatles had their Sergeant Pepper, and I guess my equivalence, Stars was kind of that. It was that moment, you know? I suppose you'd say that with True that time with yours. And you have to kind of surrender to it, I think. You know, you can't just start resenting your own success. You think, okay, that was the moment, you know. It doesn't mean to say you have to stop. You still keep trying to do it. But I just thought, holy shit, how am I ever going to follow that, you know? Especially as we were still touring, you know. We didn't stop touring till the end of 1992. We toured Stars for 2 years. And then I had to sort of, I was knackered. And I came home. And thought, well, I got to start writing songs, you know, and it just was incredibly challenging.
But it feels like the 80s went up till about 93, and I would present Suede as being like the band that came along and invented the 90s. And it sort of happened, you know, and for you being a Mancunian with what's coming next, you know, with Britpop and Oasis.
I see that slightly differently. I'm quite unashamed of the mainstream. I thought that the shift in the 90s happened with Take That. That was to me where I thought, a new generation are coming through here. I'm not the new generation anymore. I'm now establishment. And then this kind of cute little boy band turns up, and they've got a really good songwriter in Gary Barlow. So, I know that the media and the hip side of the 90s wants to talk about Oasis and Blur and Suede, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I looked to Take That and thought, well, that's a mainstream thing that's really taking off in a big way. So while I fully acknowledge what you're saying about Suede and Oasis and the importance of that, it's the way in which people eulogize in Manchester about Factory Records, you know, like it's some kind of holy grail. But they've still not sold that many albums, and they're still not that big globally. But the media talk about them like they're the biggest thing on planet Earth, you know. So fair play to them, good luck to them. But realistically speaking, I live in a mass media world. I live with 9,000 people in an auditorium. I don't live in a little club with 200 fanatics. You know what I mean? So. Yeah. I just felt it was more...
That's you told, gal. That's
no,
you
he's
told,
right. And, talking of which, because I went to see Elton John last night, and we mentioned Patrick Woodruff, who designed his show earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Patrick worked with you, didn't he? Did Simply
He Red. Did, yeah. He did, and another guy, they did the stars and the lights. In fact, it's funny you mention Elton John, because when we had the enormous success with Stars, I think I was at some sort of party... Well, I was definitely at a party, and Elton was there. And he said to me, he says, "You must have been devastated." I couldn't figure out if it was a bitchy comment or a nice comment. I was never entirely sure. But he said, "You must have been devastated when Stars didn't go in America." And I thought, well, yeah, I kind of was, but I'd still be touring there if I did. And I sort of thought to myself, no, I don't want to tour there anymore. I'm done. You know, so at the same time, I thought it was a bit of a catty remark, but nevertheless, it was true because it didn't go in America. And of course, since now, it's very popular in America. But yeah. At that time, it was very upsetting when you'd done something that was so incredibly successful everywhere except America. You
did
know?
You... Yeah, that was when was this? This was about this when you had your first big lineup change, wasn't it? Is this when Gota came into the band?
Yeah, this was my management's kind of godfather moment. You know, it didn't really come from me. It came from, as I said to you earlier, it came from them. The night of the Long Knives, where there was
fancy a drink.
There was like a reality check. No, the Gota actually is a very interesting case because another band that I thought shaped the beginning of the 90s was Soul to Soul. That first track, Keep On Moving, really hit me because it was the first song, it was the first time I'd heard drum programming that sounded organic. And, you know, it got over from that 80s clatter with that massive snare drum. You know, so many of those 80s records, they go with this backbeat of the snare. And for the first time, with the work that they were doing, it felt really soft and round and sexy and sensual. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I'd heard drum machines sounded like that. And I said to Stuart Levine, find out who does that stuff. Find out who's doing the programming for them because I want to work with them. And I'd already become friendly with Nellie Hooper, who was involved with them, who was immensely talented, did a lot of great work at that period. But the other guy that did it with him was Gota Yoshiki. And
I worked with Gota for years. That's why I bring it up.
Oh, fabulous.
Where did you work with him, Guy?
I did all sorts of projects with him in London. The Japanese band he was in at first. I'll tell you, here's the funniest one. Was at the end of his career. Sorry, little sidebar here. At the end of his career, Gary Lineker went and played in Japan. And Gota made his football record for Japan, which I played on. And the thing is, for all his many talents and his fabulous worthiness of character, one thing Gary doesn't have is any musical talent at all. So this entire record, which is based around Gary Lineker, all Gota could get out of him was him saying, one, two, three,
are go. You saying he's not as good a singer as Glenn Hoddle?
Anyway. We ended up, we brought Gota in as a drum programmer. So we our original drummer was still in the band at that time. And we went over to record in Paris.
Marconi?
I can't remember, to be honest. But the Gulf War happened all of a sudden. The hotel that we were staying in on that street was the Israeli tourist office, the Iranian and Iraqi tourist office, and they shut down the street with all these policemen. And it was like we were working in a fucking war zone, you know. And so we ended up moving from Paris to a place in outside of Venice called Villa Condolma. But anyway, what happened was Gota came in to do the programming and then just casually announced, says, oh, I play drums as well. And I'm like, oh, shit. So to get that sound, he programs and plays the drums. So that put me in a very, very difficult position with my original drummer, who'd not taken the time to do any programming. He didn't learn anything about it. He was just a drummer at that time. And that was one of the most difficult decisions in my career, because Gota was prepared to tour. He was creating the drum loops because of the playing as well, which made it difficult to have Chris play the drums with him doing the programming when Gota's very creations were based on playing the drums and the programming. So
did
that
you have to be brutal? I did.
It was horrible. It was the worst thing I've ever had to do. Was to say farewell to Chris, because Chris was a lovely, lovely person.
You lost Fritz McIntyre at that time as well.
No. Fritz didn't go until after the Life album. He was pissed off with me because I wasn't giving him any of the co-songwriting parts. It was not dissimilar to Lamont Dozier, actually, because Fritz was a great riff guy. And I would give him pieces of the song because he came up with a great riff. So they weren't technically the melody or the lyrics. He didn't do any of those. I just did it partly politically, actually, to keep them happy. That's the way it was, you know. But for example, the title track of our first album, Picture Book, I gave Fritz a songwriting credit on that because he started that riff. I don't know if you're familiar with the song, there's a riff.
Yeah.
And he also did the riff on Thrill Me, which is on the Stars album.
And he sang on Wonderland, didn't he? He sang part lead on Wonderland.
Well, yeah, but they were my lyrics and I told him what to do. So,
That was an interesting choice, though.
Yeah, I just thought it was like a good diversion and it worked really well. He was a fabulous musician, but again, he wouldn't explore the technology. He was like a pianist. He was a piano player, and he had to have a keyboard tech to take care of all the sounds and stuff. He wasn't doing that himself. And I thought at the time, guys, come on, raise your game, get into stuff, you know, start expanding your horizons. You've got to keep going. You can't sit back on your laurels. You've got to fucking push. You know, and I still feel like that. You've got to keep moving. You can't just sit back and go, I've done it now. I don't want to live like that. I want to kind of keep having a good time.
Yeah, well, let's just finish on the last album. Is it because I'm a happily married man, children, dad, you know, is it harder to write songs about yourself when you're happy?
Well, these songs are not about, a lot of them are not about myself, actually. I don't want to be disagreeable, but they're not.
No.
A couple of them are actually stories. One of them, It Wouldn't Be Me, is about a girl that's been trafficked and is ashamed of her past and won't commit to this guy that's crazy about her. And all his friends keep saying, leave her alone, she's bad news. And he won't give up on her. So it's not always about personal stuff. But one or two of the songs are. But look, Gary, we just do our best, don't we?
We do.
I'm just like writing songs because that's what I do. And I just hope that they're successful. I can't do any more than that. I'm still ambitious. I still love to write songs. And I'm still doing the best I can.
Yeah, you've got it's a proper old tour you got lined up this summer, isn't it? Those are fabulous European.
I think we're playing one of those, Guy. I think I recognise a couple of those because Guy and I play with Nick Mason. We're on the road doing that Sourceful of Secrets show, and I see you're doing some outdoors in Italy.
I hope we cross paths.
That'd be great.
I really like Nick Mason. I always have lovely conversations with him wherever we cross paths. He's a very affable chap, isn't he?
Very.
Very affable. Affable is very much the word.
Yeah, yeah. Well, give him my best, will you?
We will do.
Good luck with this album, Mick.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. Lovely talking to you guys. Very much.
Really enjoyed it, Mick. Really
I just
great.
Love
thank
I
so
just
much.
Love that, you know, you get someone on of a similar age and it's extraordinary how similar, even though you lived hundreds of miles away from me, how similar our musical stepping stones have been.
Mm-mm. Oh, well, we've followed similar paths, haven't we? Especially as two songwriters, you know, within two songwriters within a band.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good luck with the tour. Good luck with the album.
Thanks,
and thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much, man. Really, I hope we bump into you. All the very, very best.
Thank you, Guy. Lovely talking to you. You take
Cheers,
care.
Mate, yeah.
All the best. Bye.
That was really great, wasn't it, Gary?
You know what? My favourite parts are all how us chaps begin, isn't it, really? It's all that 70s stuff of youth culture and enthusiasm and tribalism and he, you know, he's got all of that information there. I was actually researching Mick. I was quite surprised to find all of that world at the beginning. I was quite surprised to find frantic elevators, to be honest.
The only question we didn't ask, which I did want to ask, which is that the frantic elevators were actually going for 7 years, which when at that age, that is an eternity.
Mm, that's right.
You know what I mean? Like, they're plugging away for 7 years, man, and then finally getting that song and then bailing.
That's right. and actually, first time Take That has ever been mentioned on the Rock on Tours.
Yeah?
I have a theory about that.
You don't think they're going to be the new prog,
no,
do you?
I do have a theory about that period, that early 90s period, and I'm glad that Mick brought it up. I might save that theory. We'll bring it out on another intro.
Save your thing, yeah. I often wonder because I know Suede kind of tend to come up now as a sort of this sort of precursor. I think Suede are kind of viewed, they are to Britpop what Eddie and the Hot Rods are to punk or Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And if you want to hear more, you can go and listen to Bernard on a previous episode, can't you? Talking about that very band, Suede. We'll have someone fantastic on next week. And thank you so much to Ben Jones, our producer, for Gimme Sugar. And thank you so much for you guys for listening. We really appreciate all your comments that you leave on social media. It's so important to us, isn't it, Guy?
It's so important, Gary. Is that the sort of response you wanted?
Right, it is. So,
it is. It absolutely.
So until then, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.